Thanks, Giovanni. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me. What I want to talk about is some joint work with Alex Efkin and Anton Zorich, and that will be most of the talk. And then at the end, perhaps I'll mention some recent work with Zorich. Okay, so the setup is where, sort of, in some sense, where Anton left off his talk this morning. I'm going to phrase things in terms of Riemann surfaces and holomorphic one-forms instead of flat surfaces, but anyway, they amount to the same thing. So I'm going to look at X as a Riemann surface and omega as a holomorphic one-form. So I'm going to look at spaces of these, and it's convenient to do the following. You fix a n-tuple of positive integers where the sum is 2g minus 2. G is the genus of the Riemann surface. So here these are closed Riemann surfaces. Now, of course, 2g minus 2 is the number of zeros of a holomorphic one-form. And then you set up the space H of alpha, which is a moduli space, or as Anton called it, a stratum. H of alpha is the set of X omega, so that omega has zeros of those orders. Perhaps surprisingly, these moduli spaces are not connected. And Konsevich and Zorich have classified the components, and I think Anton promised to tell us about that, I guess, in his third lecture. The focus of this talk is really about how these spaces are not compact. One kind of immediate reason for that is that there can be a short saddle connection. So what is a saddle connection? So you have a singularity and perhaps another singularity of the abelian differential, and you have this flat structure for the abelian differential or translation surface structure, and a saddle connection is a straight line joining one singularity to another, or possibly back to itself, in which case it's a loop, and it doesn't go through other singularities on the way. So they can be short. You could shorten them, and you leave compact sets of this moduli space. So the interest here is to describe sort of the cusps. I'm going to use the word very lightly. So if it's not compact, one is interested in what do these spaces look like at infinity. And, I mean, that's of importance for a number of places, and I will talk about one application a little bit later. Now, what I want to start off with is the following example to indicate that cusps can be pretty complicated. So here's my example. I'm going to take a sort of a standard torus, flat torus, a 1x1 torus, and this is a very small torus, a delta-by-delta torus. And inside each torus, I'm going to take, let's say, a vertical line of length epsilon. Here, epsilon is less than delta, not really matter much. Okay, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to cut this torus open along this segment. I'm going to think of it as a slit. Cut that one open along the slit, and then I'm going to glue them pairwise. What you get is, so I'm going to glue these two slits together. So you're taking a connected sum of two tori, and you get a genus 2 abelian differential, a genus 2 flat surface. And if I let epsilon go to 0 and I let delta go to 0, I'm certainly leaving compact sets of this moduli space. I should say here, as I wrote, the slit becomes a pair of saddle connections on a genus 2 surface. So it's a pair because you're cutting it open and gluing. You could compare the hyperbolic. So you could ask, what's happening to the Riemann surfaces? Forget the holomorphic one-form. You could ask what's happening on the Riemann surfaces themselves, and in particular, what's happening to the conformal structure or the hyperbolic metric, in particular, of this genus 2 Riemann surface. And one can check that the slit curve, which is a this dividing curve on this genus 2 surface. In the hyperbolic metric, its length will go to zero. And that's the only curve whose length goes to zero in the hyperbolic metric. These curves of flat length delta, where delta is going to zero, they don't go to zero in the hyperbolic metric. So in the world of moduli space of Riemann surfaces, or in other words, in the, say, in the compactification, the Deline-Mumford compactification, the hyperbolic limit is actually quite nice. It's a couple of tori glued together at a point. So here I'm letting epsilon go to zero and even let delta go to zero with it. In the flat metric, it's a little bit bizarre because this sort of right-hand torus is sort of disappearing. And in the flat metric, it's not quite clear what to make of the limit, or you've lost something if you only keep the left-hand side. So what I want to do is sort of not deal with those kinds of deformations. This is an unfortunate deformation. It's unfortunate in that there are a short curve epsilon and another short curve delta that doesn't have to be short. In other words, there's nothing in this picture, in the situation, that forces delta to be short. I could have taken another kind of standard torus and done the same construction. So let me formalize that a little bit. So what I'm saying here is that the issue is that there are other short curves other than that slit curve. And now I want to make a remark. If I have two saddle connections, gamma 1 and gamma 2, and they're homologous, and I have this one form omega, of course, the integral of omega on gamma 1 is equal to the integral of omega on gamma 2. That common integral is called the holonomy of the saddle connection. And of course, that means if gamma 1 is short, so is gamma 2, because they have the same holonomy vector. So as soon as you have homologous saddle connections, and one of them is short, the other is short, and sort of an obvious statement. So here is what I want to call the thick part of the cusp. So there's a lot of epsilons and thicks and alphas and so forth, but it's the set of x omega in h of alpha, such that there's a saddle connection of length, that should be length less than or equal to epsilon, and all non-homologous saddle connections are not short. Now, there's a quantifier missing here, but of what not short means, but it means somehow not bounded below, away from zero. So the thick part of the cusp is where you have saddle connections that are short, other ones that are homologous to it are short, and everything else not homologous to it is long or moderate length. And so that's this sort of thick part of the cusp is what we want to study. Now, a comment about that. First of all, if saddle, and here is sort of an interesting, I mean, a more or less obvious point, but worth mentioning. If you have two saddle connections that are homologous, then, and you deform the, you deform the surface. So the deformation here is of the surface. If they're homologous to begin with, then they're going to be homologous under a small deformation. And they will continue to be homologous until somehow a saddle connection breaks up. So what can happen is that you can have a saddle connection and then you change the surface, and then another singularity of the surface somehow appears and under a deformation gets in the way, and then this saddle connection is no longer a saddle connection because it runs into another singularity. So the key point here is small deformations. It's not some global deformation that keeps you in the world of homologous saddle connections. And so that what that says is that one should really, that means that surfaces with homologous saddle connections represent an open set in this moduli space, in this stratum. And the problem is to classify the components of the thick part. So this, we're talking about the cusp, and the cusp will break up into different components. And one is interested in studying the components of the thick part. And I should say, again, why one in particular is interested in the thick part is because the thick part will represent most of the cusp. with respect to a natural volume or measure form on the whole stratum. So that first example I had where I had a regular sized torus and then a really tiny one, that's going to represent the set of all genus 2 surfaces that you can build that way is going to be represent a very, very small proportion of the measure, and somehow in the limit we're sort of not interested in it. Okay, so somehow the problem is what's in blue is to somehow classify these components. Okay, so to say a little bit more, and then I want to talk about, I guess, three examples. So suppose you have a surface in this thick part. So that means, again, you have short saddle connections of length less than or equal to epsilon, and no other short saddle connections. So the only short ones are the ones where are these homologous collection. And there's a sort of a canonical way of collapsing these short saddle connections to get a new abelian differential, a new Riemann surface X prime, and a new holomorphic one-form W prime that lives on some simpler surface. Now, it could be, I'll see in some examples, it's either simpler because it's somehow you've collapsed zeros, or you could lower the genus, but somehow this operation reduces the complexity of the surface. And this surface X prime omega prime that we get is, we say that it belongs, it's going to be a new, some new moduli space, H alpha prime, some new moduli space, and we're going to call this the principal boundary of the moduli space that we started with. The principal boundary of the moduli space with respect to some collection of homology curves. Okay, here's a first example and the absolutely easiest one to understand. Suppose we're in genus 2, H11, that means there are two simple zeros. And suppose we have a single saddle connection, gamma of length, some really small length, epsilon, joining them. We can collapse that saddle connection to a point. We get there's a canonical way of doing that. You get a new Riemann surface X prime omega prime, and you collapse the zeros of order 1 into a zero of order 2, and you end up in the stratum H2 in genus 2, which is the set of surfaces with a zero of order 2. And you can go backwards. So going backwards means starting here and building a surface in here with a short saddle connection. So you do that as follows. You can go backwards. Okay. So you're given some surface with a double order zero. And you're going to give yourself a vector of length epsilon. So that's going to be, at the end of the day, the holonomy vector of that saddle connection. And there's, again, a canonical way of breaking up that zero into a pair of zeros of order 1, or degree 1, together with a saddle connection V joining them, a saddle connection gamma joining them with holonomy vector V. So here's sort of a schematic picture. Here's the zero of order 2. I'm going to take, now what I've drawn here for a zero of order 2, I've sort of picked so V has a direction and a length, it's a vector. And what I've drawn here are the six separatrices, or the six flow lines coming out of the zero in the direction of V. So these are all in direction V, all six of those. And I've broken up the zero into two simple zeros. Here the picture looks vertical. V is somehow looks like a vertical vector. I've broken up the zero into two simple zeros with that saddle connection joining them. Now, there's a curiosity about this picture, which is that there were actually different choices. There is sort of a combinatorial picture, information that goes along with this picture. In this picture, maybe if I label these separatrices A, B, and C. And then those are A, B, and C, and then here's, of course, some other D, E, F. In this picture, the ABCs go together. So A, B, C are joined at that singularity, and the D, E, F are joined at that singularity. I've sort of grouped the A, B, C separatrice together and the D, E, F together. But I could have grouped, for instance, A, B, and D together, and C, E, and F together, and broken it up that way. So that would be a sort of a similar picture, but these three would be grouped together and these three would be grouped together. And I could also group A, D, and E together and B, C, and F. So there are actually three ways of doing this breaking up. So for a given vector of length epsilon, there are actually three ways of breaking up the zero. I've just sort of schematically drawn one of them. But there are really three ways of doing this, depending on how you want to group these separatrices coming out after the deformation. And so here is sort of a schematic picture of what H alpha, so H alpha, in my case here, this is H11, and this is H2, is sort of a schematic picture of what it looks like. So here is H2, it's sort of represented by the dark line. And then for all small epsilon, and all vectors of length epsilon, so that represents a disk in, say, in the complex plane, or the disk of radius epsilon in the complex plane, for any V of length epsilon, I'm going to sort of get a disk. And there are three ways of doing this, three ways of breaking it up. So what I can somehow schematically picture is that the space H alpha sitting, the way it's sort of attached, the H11, the way it's attached to H2 is here you have H2, and at each point in H2, you have three disks sort of as a fiber over that point corresponding to the three ways you could break up the vector. And so there's sort of a picture perhaps of the way H11, this one stratum or this one moduli space looks compared to that one. And the work that I'm sort of in general is to do this in all possible genera and all possible situations. So let me give a second example of the same idea. Okay. So I should probably hate to do this, but cover up something here. Pardon me? Yes, just think of it as a branching locus. That's right. It's sort of like a branch cover. Okay. So a second example is again in H11. And that's sort of the first example that I drew where you had two tori. Now suppose you have homologous saddle connections, gamma 1, gamma 2, on a surface with two simple zeros. Okay, now you collapse. So now they're homologous. So they divide the surface of genus 2 into two tori. If you collapse, you get a pair of tori. So H empty set means there are no zeros. So this is a flat torus. So these are flat tori. Flat torus. Okay. So when you collapse, when you have two homologous saddle connections in H11, and you collapse, the principal boundary is the product space of flat tori with itself. And you can go back and build any surface here from something in there with a similar kind of construction. In fact, that was more or less the first picture I drew. Suppose you have two flat tori, and then you have some segment, or you're given some vector of length epsilon. Now these are flat torus, so they're homogeneous, so you could put that vector anywhere you want. But anyway, you take this two segments of vectors, two segments which represent vectors of length epsilon, and then you do this slit construction, cutting and gluing, and you build yourself a surface in H11. So you can go backwards in, forwards and backwards in that picture as well. A third example, which maybe is not so great drawn schematically, is the following. Again, we're in H11. Here's a third example. Here are the two simple zeros. Now suppose, leaving this zero in some direction, the saddle connection comes back to itself. So that's a loop. And in this particular picture, because it comes back with angle pi here, this actually has to bound a cylinder, which I've tried to draw in green, and that actually forces there to be, for example, a loop, homologous loop, gamma 2, from the other zero coming back to itself. And gamma 1 and gamma 2 will be the top and bottom of a cylinder sitting inside the surface. So this is an example now of a cylinder sitting inside the surface. They bound, gamma 1 and gamma 2 bound a cylinder, and you could assume, let's assume that that cylinder is very, very short, that the length of gamma 1 is very, very, equaling the length of gamma 2 is very, very small. You could deform by pinching and letting that length go to zero, and you get something in, you get again get a flat torus. So the, by pinching, you end up with now a single flat torus. So here the principal boundary of this scenario is the flat torus. So what I want to emphasize here, in all three examples, I get, so let me, I guess, put them back up here for just a second. In H11, a single saddle connection, that's the principal boundary. It's H2. If there's a pair of homologous saddle connections, you get a different principal boundary, torus cross torus. And here is another scenario, another, the last one is an H11. If your homology class is a loop, you get a third principal boundary. So the principal boundary here depends on the collection of saddle connections, the homology classes of the collection of saddle connections. And so we sort of formalize this by talking what we call a configuration. So a configuration is a collection of homologous saddle connections, one or two or more, depending on the genus. Now here, I haven't said what they do. They may join distinct zeros, or they may come back to themselves. And so there's a sort of a ambiguity. I haven't specified precisely what that means, collection of homologous saddle connections. Depends on the situation one is interested in. And then you specify the topology of the complementary surface. So for example, let me draw one more picture here, configuration. See if I can draw it correctly. Say you're in genus 5 or something. Probably not do it right. So here is a 0 and another 0. So those are two, they're homologous because they cut off gamma 1, gamma 2, because they cut off genus 2 versus genus 3, that there could be a third one homologous to that, gamma 3. So those three are all homologous, and now there might be some zeros in the interior of that surface, probably not here because it's a torus, but a configuration amounts to specifying, say, a certain number of homologous saddle connections joining distinct zeros or to themselves, specifying which, the genus of the surface they cut off, the angles they make with each other, and all sorts of sort of topological data. So that's what is meant by, what we mean by a configuration. So it's a collection of homologous saddle connections, and you specify the topology. And those are in one-to-one correspondence with the components of the cusps, the connected components of the cusps. And for every one of those, you get this principal boundary by collapsing. And you get this by collapsing. And vice versa, starting with something in here, you can go back and rebuild the surface in the stratum that you, by some kind of construction, splitting up zeros. There are a number of geometric constructions that allow you to go backwards. So I described really two of them. There are finitely many configurations, yes. So, well, without, so there's a more than a little bit vague, but one of the contents of this work with Alex Eskin and Anton Zoric is that we've classified all the configurations in all possible moduli spaces, all possible strata, actually all components of all strata. So we sort of have classified all of these configurations. Okay. So, and so forth, somehow all principal boundaries. Now, okay, so why should you care? Well, let me give one application of this, and that's to an application is, so what I was describing is short saddle connections, and now I don't want to talk about short saddle connections, I want to talk about long saddle connections. And the application is to counting long saddle connections or loops. So by, you know, I mean, loops are examples of saddle connections. I want to count saddle connections on a translations on a surface X omega. So I want to look at all sort of possible saddle connections. So there are certainly infinitely many of them, and I'm somehow interested in counting them. Okay, so actually, I mean, this problem had its origin in some ways in, well, it has its analog, at least, in counting problems in lattices and Lie groups. So what is the setup? Suppose you're given one of these configurations, and I'm calling it script C. Now, that might be a single saddle connection is a configuration. So one saddle connection, or maybe a pair of saddle connections. That's a configuration. Well, I haven't told you how it, what genera it cuts off, but maybe again in here, single saddle connection. I mean, again, the example that's worth just thinking about is in H11. That is genus 2 with two zeros, a single saddle connection. Or maybe counting on this surface X omega in this on a surface in here, pairs of saddle connections. Now, I want to emphasize there are, on any given surface, if you have two zeros, there are infinitely many saddle connections joining one to the other. They just tend to get very, very long. Or, actually, it turns out that given two zeros, there are always infinitely many pairs of homologous saddle connections joining the two zeros. And so one wants to count how many there are of a given length. Okay, so the setup is the following. I'm going to call there's this space V. So here's it depends on the surface X and omega. It's the set of holonomy vectors of saddle connections giving that configuration. So whatever that configuration is, this is the set of all possible vectors I get. Set of all possible vectors. So that's this space. There are infinitely many elements in it because there are infinitely many saddle connections. But I want to count the number of length less than or equal to some number, say L, and ask about the asymptotics of that. So let me describe a theorem here. I think the credit really for this idea is really due to Veitch, so that's why his name is at the top, and then Eskin and I picked up on it afterwards, but the original idea is due to Veitch. Okay, so here's the theorem. So you take each component, take any component of your stratum and any configuration C that you like. Then there is a constant which depends on the alpha and also depends on the configuration. I didn't want to put another script C there, with the following property. Okay, so this constant depends on just this topological data and that topological data as well. So that for almost every surface, so the key point here is almost every, for almost every surface in that connected component, if you count the number of saddle connections in the ball of radius L, so BL is the ball of radius L, in R2. So if you count the number of saddle connections in the ball of radius L, divide by the area of the ball, disc I should say. So count the number of saddle connections whose length is in that, divide by the area, that this converges as L goes to infinity to that constant. And that convergence holds for almost every surface in the stratum, in the connected component. So another way of saying this is that the number of saddle connections in your configuration grows quadratically asymptotically, grows like a constant times pi L squared as L goes to infinity. Okay, now, fine. The interest here in the application is how do we compute this constant C alpha? So one is interested in actually, the theorem doesn't just tells us that there is a constant. It doesn't tell us how to compute it. And this is how it's computed by what's called the Siegel-Veach formula. And so the origins of this are because there's a corresponding notion in counting lattice points for lattices that goes back to Siegel, and it's sort of a similar idea, and then it was sort of reintroduced into the subject by Veach, and then we sort of picked up on it. So what is the Siegel-Veach formula? You start with a function in a continuous function of compact support in R2. Let's see if I can manage to do something. No, neither way. Okay. Okay, so you start with a continuous function, and you define a new function f hat from the moduli space to the reals as follows. You evaluate it at every x omega as follows. You look at all of the vectors in the space, so VC here are all of the saddle connections. That's a collection of vectors. So this is a collection of vectors determining saddle connections. You look at all of those vectors and evaluate your function at that vector and sum it up. Now, because the function is compact support, this is well-defined finite valued. I mean, this set here is infinite, but the function has compact support, so that's, there's a finite number of vectors. Where f is non-zero, and so this is this corresponding function f hat. So you at each surface you evaluate your function on the saddle connections, on the vectors corresponding to the saddle connections. Okay, and here's the Siegel-Veach formula. It says that if you integrate that function f hat over the moduli space with respect to there's a canonical measure. You divide by the volume or the measure of the space, then that's equal to the Siegel-Veach constant that appeared in the quadratic asymptotics. So this is the constant appearing in the quadratic asymptotics. And then integral of this is on R2. Okay, so that's called the Siegel-Veach formula. And as I say, there's a complete analog of this in the world of G mod gamma for GLE group and gamma lattice, which is where Siegel came from. That's why the name Siegel is there. Okay, you take, now I want to apply this formula. I want to take F to be the characteristic function of a ball or a disk of radius epsilon. Now, not quite continuous, but never mind. Okay, the right-hand side is just the area of the disk. Integrating the characteristic function is the area times the C alpha. Okay, so what's this? Well, F hat only gives something positive. So F is the characteristic function of a disk of radius epsilon. F hat only gives you something non-zero if you have a vector of length less than or equal to epsilon. So f hat gives you a 1 if you have a vector of length less than or equal to epsilon, and it gives you a 0 if you don't. So what you're measuring then by integrating that function, you're integrating 1 over the set of surfaces with a vector of length less than or equal to epsilon. Well, that's the volume of that space. So this integral is just the volume of the thick part. You get a You get a 1 if you have a vector of length less than epsilon. You get a 0 if you don't. So you're integrating 1 over the set of surfaces with a short vector, and that's the volume of the thick part. Yeah, well, okay. So this should be taken to be asymptotic. I'm going to do asymptotic here. And this, the formulas become absolutely correct as you let epsilon go to 0. Okay, so thick part is where I've got my saddle connections of length. So it's paradoxical because thick is there are short saddle connections. But what I mean by the thick part is that there's a short saddle connection and there are no other short saddle connections other than the ones that are forced to be short because they're homologous. So in other words, there's the short saddle connection and everything else is in the usual sense of thick. That is, there's nothing else short. Okay, so this formula is correct asymptotically, and it's that's right. You fix the cusp, and it's the thick part. It's the thick part of the cusp. What? Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, I can. Yeah. Well, sure. But the point is that I want to put thick in because I want to relate to this to the picture. I want to relate it to the picture that I've been trying to develop. Okay, so what I want to do is I'm interested in what is the... So the reason that this... okay, the reason that this formula is nice, would be nice, is if we can find the volume of the thick part in terms of epsilon. So we're interested in the constant C alpha. Okay? So what we're interested in is the volume of the thick part. The epsilon thick part. Now, the reason I introduced the previous discussion is I can relate the volume of the epsilon thick part to the volume of the principal boundary that I get by collapsing. So, here's what then this picture looks like. So here I'm, okay. So the picture, remember the picture was something like this. Here was some sort of principal boundary, and then the thick part was there were a bunch of disks that were sticking on sort of some sort of fiber construction, some sort of ramified cover construction. So here was H alpha thick, epsilon, some picture like that. That's the space up here. Okay, so what this really is saying is this picture is saying that the measure or the volume of this thick part of the cusp is the volume of the principal boundary times the measure of each one of those disks, which is pi epsilon squared, times some sort of combinatorial information, which is how those disks are, how you break up zeros and sort of combinatorial information. The one example I drew where I broke up one zero of order two into two single zeros, there were three ways of doing it and there were three disks. So the volume of the thick part will be the volume of the principal boundary times pi epsilon squared times 3, because there are 3 of those disks. And so you put that together, this combinatorial thing is not always an integer because there can be symmetries. Sometimes we have to divide by the order of symmetries of the surface. So it's an integer divided by, it's a rational number. Okay, this is a rational number. How's that? And the denominator is bounded by the genus by the it's a combinatorial constant. The denominator is never bigger than something in terms of the genus. Okay, so all right. So what does this left side look like? It looks, I've now written it here. It's 1 over the volume. That's again. Here's pi epsilon squared. And then there's some combinatorial constant, which, depending on the problem, can be computed. Here's the volume of the principal boundary. And then that's equal, this is approximately equal to the Siegel-Veitch constant, the one we care about, pi epsilon squared. And this approximate becomes an equal sign as we let epsilon go to 0. So we let epsilon go to 0. And we get well, the pi epsilon squares cancel, and we get a formula for the Siegel-Veitch constant. Again, that's the asymptotic growth. It's some combinatorial constant. The volume of the principal boundary divided by the volume of the space you were in. So there's a nice formula for this asymptotic growth. And what's even better is all of these volumes of all of these components of all strata have all been computed by Eskin and Okunkov, all of these volumes. And so one can write down this asymptotic constant in every configuration in all genera and whatever. So all the C alphas can be computed, are computed. Okay. So that was sort of the application that I had in mind to this picture. And the picture was, again, you're interested in counting long saddle connections, and you count them by squeezing them and going to the principal boundary. Okay, in the last sort of 5 minutes, 7 minutes, I don't think I have that much. Okay, so so that's the picture of abelian differentials, and now let me describe in the last few minutes some more recent work with Anton Zoric, where we extend this whole business to quadratic differentials. Now, you could say this is generalization for generalization's sake, but the important point here is that, as I will do with an example, is that the notion of homologous has to be changed. Because now you don't have a one form with a quadratic differential, you have a quadratic differential. And so the notion of what homology is supposed to mean changes, and there are more phenomena that can happen. And again, why do we care about homology? Because when two saddle connections are homologous, then they persist under a small deformation. That was sort of the basic principle. So you have an entire open sets of homologous saddle connections. They cover a big part of the moduli space, so that one cannot ignore them. So what the issue is, what is to replace the notion of homology with where we had a one form, now we have a quadratic differential. Well, I mean, the first part of the story is kind of standard. XQ, so Q is a quadratic differential. What's the right notion of homologous? What notion persists under deformation? So that's more or less the same. So the part of the story that is completely standard is if you're given a quadratic differential Q on X, you can pass to a twofold branch cover, X hat, by taking the square root of the quadratic differential, I mean, in quotes. So there's a twofold branch cover. It's branched over the odd order singularities of the quadratic differential. Gives you a twofold branch cover, X hat. There's a one form on X hat, whose square, which is then a quadratic differential, is the pullback of Q. So there's a standard notion of taking the square root of a quadratic differential, which passes them to a double cover. Okay, so now let me. Let's write the first line here. So each saddle connection gamma, because it's a double cover, has two lifts, and I'll call them gamma prime and gamma double prime. Okay, so let me reserve that slide. So let me give an example where a new phenomenon can take place. Okay, so here's the example up top. So what is this? Okay, what is this? This is supposed to be a torus. Okay, it's a torus, but now I should have said the quadratic differential is allowed to have simple poles. Should have said that. Q is allowed simple poles. Why do we allow that? Well, simple poles, you still have finite area. And so that should still be allowed. And also you get more interesting examples. So here is the picture. here is this a torus. Now let's see. I'm going to glue alpha the left to the right. Now on this left side here of this rectangle, I'm gluing beta going in this direction to I'm gluing this segment in this direction to this segment going in the opposite direction. So that automatically puts it out of the world of abelian differentials because you're gluing things in after a rotation of pi, which is not allowed for an abelian differential. And similarly on the right side, then I glue the top to the bottom. Okay? Now, so I claim this is a torus. Now, this point and this point are sort of special because they're not identified with any other points, and the angle going around this point is just pi. So the total angle around that point is pi. So that's a simple pole. So this point, P, is a simple pole with angle pi. And so is Q, that point. So P and Q are poles that are simple poles. Okay, here is gamma 1. So that's a saddle connection joining the simple pole to itself. So this is a single saddle connection going from a simple pole to itself. That's gamma 1. Now, schematically, gamma 3, this point is identified with that. And so gamma 3 is a loop. And so is gamma 2, because that point is identified with that. So that's a loop. And so what we get here is this is a cylinder. Okay, and we have a loop on the top and a loop on, two loops at the top joined together. And then the rest of the, there's a cylinder attached. Here's a cylinder, which is one boundary component is attached to that loop, and another boundary component is attached to that loop. So this is here is a cylinder, and you're attaching another cylinder to it. But this is a kind of a funny looking cylinder, in a sense. The one boundary component is a segment from a pole to itself, and the other boundary are a pair of loops joined at a point. Okay, that's the quadratic differential. And now what I want to do is pass through the double cover. Okay, so I want to take the square root of this and pass through the double cover and see what we get. Okay, so, here it is. Okay, so here's the picture on the double cover. So this is x hat. Okay, so this picture of three rectangles joined together, it's going to be duplicated twice. So here are the here's the double cover, three of them and three more. And, well, without going through all the details, this is the gluing pattern. You're going to have alpha prime glued to alpha prime, beta prime to beta prime, beta double prime. So those are the two lifts of beta. This is the two lifts. This is one lift of alpha, and I guess here is the other lift of alpha, alpha double prime. Okay, so those are all the lifts of the curves that I had over here. And now here's the picture. This is a surface of genus 2. Okay, so here's the picture. The lift of that gamma 1. So gamma 1 downstairs was just a saddle connection joining a pole to itself. In the lift, it has two pieces, gamma 1 prime and gamma 1 double prime, and they are sort of in the middle of a cylinder in the double cover. The lift of the pole, this becomes a regular point in the double cover. When you lift a simple pole, it becomes a regular point, no singularity at all. So this is actually just an ordinary loop. Okay, and there are all these ones that are homotopic to it. Okay, gamma 2 prime lifts, here are its two lifts, and here are gamma 3 prime and its two lifts. And what one sees, and then there's a cylinder, attached to the top coming around to the bottom, and another cylinder attached to the top coming around to the bottom. And that's the picture. So there's a cylinder and then two cylinders attached. And that's the picture of the double cover. Now, what's curious about this is that when we lift to the double cover, the lift of gamma 1, which is those two curves, all of a sudden becomes homologous to the lift of gamma 2. So here's gamma 2. Here's the lift of gamma 2, these two curves. Here's the lift of gamma 3, those two curves. So all of a sudden in double cover, gamma 1 becomes homologous to in the lift. Gamma 1 becomes homologous to gamma 2 in the lift, and gamma 1 becomes homologous to gamma 3 in the lift. And then if one were to perturb this, or let's put it this way, if we were to take this picture and then somehow perturb it in this stratum, we would get this picture every time under a local perturbation, and what we would see is that the length of gamma 1 is forced to be, well, gamma 1 plus gamma 1 prime is forced to equal gamma 2 prime plus gamma 2 plus gamma 2 prime because they're homologous. Okay, so the gist of the story is that a saddle connection, so this is a saddle connection, this is a loop. A saddle connection all of a sudden becomes homologous to a loop in the double cover. So I'm going to call it hat homologous because it's homologous in the double cover. So this is a phenomenon that we did not see in abelian differentials. Saddle connections were not homologous to loops. Saddle connections were homologous to other saddle connections. Loops could be homologous to loops. Okay, so that means that there's a whole new story here of new things that can happen. And let me finish by not describing any more examples, but just sort of saying what we did. Okay, so in this example, the lift of gamma 1 is homologous to the lift of gamma 2 and to the lift of gamma 3. Okay, so using this notion of homologous in the lifts, we define configurations of homologous saddle connections for quadratic differentials. And what I'm trying to drive at here is that the story is more complicated than it is for abelian differentials. To each configuration, we get a principal boundary by collapsing, the same notion. And here is a very vague theorem, but nonetheless what we have accomplished. We classify all possible configurations of homology and all possible principal boundaries in all genus and so forth and so on. Okay, I think that's where I will stop. Thank you.